Thank you, Patrick. I'm so happy to be here. I walk in the door and feel so welcome. Thank you so much for inviting me into your Dharma home, Kokyo. It's Kokyo with whom I corresponded to make this happen, but I'm sure many other people are involved in making what is happening here right now possible, so thank you all. One of my dearest friends when I was a teenager moved to my hometown in central Iowa from Santa Cruz, and he made it sound like Santa Cruz was a wonderland, a magical place. And when I come here, it turns out it's true. So I'm very happy. And I apologize for just wearing my somewhat casual Zen garments. I've been living out of my car for a few weeks because this is a very long teaching tour that I'm on, and so things are, I thought my robes were not fit for presentation. Frankly, things are getting a little messy. So anyway, I'm so glad to be here. And you know, the theme of my talk is mindfulness and intimacy, and I just got to say I'm happy that you're willing to have me back, because at a number of Zen centers and other Buddhist centers where I have taught before, when I contacted them, they were like, yeah, mindfulness? Eh. They're sort of like, tired of that. So I'm not tired of mindfulness. I think it's really quite wonderful, and I'm definitely not tired of intimacy. So just to frame what I'm doing here, I'm going to read a brief, the first paragraph of the chapter in here called Mindfulness, and then the first chapter of the first paragraph of the chapter on intimacy. And of course, mindfulness and intimacy are things that everyone knows quite a bit about. They're natural capacities of all human beings. And hopefully people who come to a place like this have been cultivating these. So maybe you have a deeper understanding. But I don't think we're going to run out of things that we can develop in this regard. Mindfulness is being aware of things in the present moment in a way that promotes well-being. To practice mindfulness is to choose some aspect of our experience and focus attention there in a sustained way. There is discernment in mindfulness, but it is non-judgmental. It is kind. It allows the mind to rest in the phenomena of the present moment and take a break from creating a relentless stream of imaginations about the future, reviews of the past, or judgments of the present. Our awareness is one of the most amazing and powerful things we have as human beings. Rather than taking it for granted and allowing it to focus wherever the mind's habits choose, with mindfulness, we can better focus awareness on things that are truly beneficial. And intimacy. Intimacy, in its simplest definition, means close familiarity and friendship. Words, however, have power and meaning beyond their definitions. No matter what the dictionary says, some words evoke very different meanings or feelings to different people. To some folks, the word religion evokes inspiration, warmth, and wonder. To others, constriction and closed-mindedness. I have noticed both types of people tend to come to Zen centers. Intimacy is a word a bit like this. It can evoke feelings of connection and safety, but for some people, it's pretty scary or stickily sentimental. And then there are the folks who think it just means sex, who will be really disappointed by this talk, if that's why you came here. I'm sorry. Here, I will be pointing towards a way of understanding and experiencing the word intimacy that fosters compassion, calm, and joyful action. I use intimacy here as we often use it in Zen discourse. It's about harmony between autonomy and interdependence. In intimacy, we are individuals who are connected, and we are also one undivided whole. We can develop both healthy boundaries and healthy boundarylessness. So the way I talk about mindfulness is pretty conventional. It's just based in study and practice with the early Pali Canon texts on mindfulness, like the Four Foundations of Mindfulness Sutra. But the way I'm using the word intimacy is a little bit unconventional. I mean, at root, it does just mean familiarity. So I would say from a Zen perspective or from a Mahayana Buddhist perspective, intimacy is how things are. So if we take into our hearts the idea that each thing arises from infinite conditions or from everything else, and each thing is also conditioning everything else, I don't know how things could get more familiar and close than that. Everything is always completely operating together in this total dynamic family. They say Zen, they often say in old texts, Zen is family-style practice. And what is the literature says? Intimate transmission from mind to mind, the intimate transmission of thusness. So this intimacy is like how things are, and our awareness of it is various. So at times, people feel very deeply connected to what's going on, and their energy naturally flows in a beneficial way. And at times, people feel very alienated, and their energy tends to flow in a very constricted way, and they create a lot of waves and problems. We're all, I think, like this. So, arguably, when we are feeling, when we would describe ourselves as feeling more intimate, it's just basically when we're getting closer to perceiving how things actually are. So, one of the reasons I wanted to write this book is that we are living in a culture which seems to be swept up in a mindfulness trend. Oh my goodness. You've probably noticed. Isn't it everywhere? Mindful coloring books at the checkout counter. Mindful exercise programs. I literally got an invitation to co-write an article on mindful exercise. Wonderful. I think this is, I am participating in this, so there may be people who think, oh, bad. That's okay. You can think that. I participate in the secular mindfulness world and provide mindfulness training outside of a Zen or religious context to a lot of recovering addicts and alcoholics in particular, and police training is the other main avenue where I do that. And I hope it is beneficial. But there are very reasonable and valuable critiques of the way mindfulness is being swept up into American culture. Mindfulness being sort of the root of how it's being swept into culture, coming from Buddhism, and yet it's being sort of extracted, and so much of Buddhism is being left behind. So there are many excellent critiques, but the one that rings the most true to me is that you might go to your job and you are required to attend a mindfulness training, and the person providing the mindfulness training might be saying something like, just learn to accept everything exactly how it is. And I'm here to say I'm not at all interested in people accepting everything exactly how it is. If you take the idea that we are all intimately involved with everything to heart, that means that the fact that we live in a country which is characterized by white supremacy and patriarchy, where homophobia and transphobia are endemic, where we have an economic system which is massively damaging to many people, and where we are consuming in a way that is devastating our brothers and sisters of other animal species and plant species, the idea that we would find a way for everyone to just accept how that is does not seem helpful at all. And it brings to mind, now's where I potentially get in a lot of trouble because I'm going to quote Karl Marx. I am not a Marxist, nor am I propounding on Zen Marxism. But Marx was an insightful person. He once said, religion is the opiate of the masses. So I think religion is quite wonderful, and I'm a priest. But he was pointing out something that can happen with religion, is that it becomes taken up into power structures that exist and used as a way to tamp down people's work to try and transform systems so that people can be well. So this is part of what's happening with mindfulness in American culture, and this is something that I would really like to see us work to transform. Because mindfulness is intended to be something that is for liberation, for freeing people from suffering. So another thing about the mindfulness movement that's not so great is it's like I meet a lot of people who are like, oh yeah, I do this all the time. I go and give a training and they're like, I'm already doing this. I have my app and I just, you know, on the way to work, I just listen to my app. And apps are very wonderful. Maybe you make apps. I'm in the place where people make lots of apps, I think, or close. So anyway, they get this idea, if you read the New York Times, the wellness, you should just meditate 10 minutes a day. And there are all the ideas like you just do this in your house by yourself, isolated units of mellowing out a little bit. Mindfulness came up within a tradition of community, of doing something together for everyone. Now, of course, I'm kind of preaching to the choir here. You all showed up at this great place where you're obviously building community. But recognizing that we're part of this thing where people can be losing that and that we're holding something that really matters. Audre Lorde, the great womanist, essayist, and poet once said, without community, there is no liberation. From a Dharma perspective, you got greed, hatred, and delusion. You can be as free as you want from greed and hatred or from a desire and aversion, but if you don't recognize your intimacy with everything, you're massively deluded. Our freedom has to come with everyone. So my idea for framing this in this way, so kind of another way to look at the way I'm talking about mindfulness and intimacy is like mindfulness is what I would call an object-based meditation methodology. So it's a central meditation methodology of early Buddhism or like Theravadan Buddhism. So basically you methodically identify parts of your experience and you pick them out and you go, I'm going to focus on this. So you start with the breath and then you move to the whole body. And then you start thinking about other things with the body, postures, death. Then you start noticing qualities of mind. I'm skipping over some stuff, but you get the idea. So you start to notice, oh, there's desire in me, there's aversion in me. So it's very systematic, and there's all like discrete elements. It's very good. And many of you have probably practiced with this and know lots about it. Now, if you read Mahayana literature, classical Mahayana literature, the term mindfulness doesn't tend to occur very much, or maybe even at all. It's removed, if you think about the basic path systems, you have the Eightfold Path in early Buddhism, which has mindfulness, and you have the Six Paramitas in Mahayana, which does not. And I think the main reason is, with Mahayana Buddhism, the emphasis is on jumping in to the intimacy that's already here. And why would you bother making and training your mind to make objects out of this what is naturally complete? And say, oh, there's this feeling over here, and there's that kind of thing with my mind over here, and there's... Why do all that? You're just training your mind to do the very thing that cuts you off from the universe. So we get a lot of critique of mindfulness. And this is valid, but my favorite Dharma teacher, Vasubandhu, presents a vision of practice which integrates this radical emphasis of Mahayana on non-dualism, of leaping into intimacy right now, with mindfulness as a discerning, psychologically careful practice of healing. And he says both of these together are going to be much more powerful than either one separate. And I hold this to be an excellent way of looking at practice. So here you could say mindfulness is representing object-based practices, this psychological acuity of early Buddhism, and intimacy is this non-dual, more holistic approach of the Mahayana. So our capacities as human beings to recognize intimacy or feel intimacy are personal and state dependent. That means they're all different for each of us, and they occur in at different times depending on conditions differently for each of us. So just really easy examples like sex. Sex can be an experience of profound intimacy, but it can also be an experience of extreme alienation depending on conditions and the people. Or me, I'm like a nature boy. So I've been traveling around the country, and the great thing about it is I can come to a place like this and meet wonderful people and hang out and do Dharma, and then the next night I can go in the woods and I can just walk around, and I just go out and I see the leaves shaking in the breeze, and I hear the birds and the sky and the just dirt. Nothing I see is made for people. It's just co-evolved in its own way, and I just open up. My sense of alienation quiets down. I feel a connection, an expansiveness, an intimacy with life. And there are probably people in this room who are like this, who are like, yeah. You know, you meet people all the time, you go, I'm spiritual, but not religious. And haven't you heard people say, when I go out in the woods, that's my church? I've heard multiple people say that. Wonderful. On the other hand, just as I gave the first talk on this book at Minnesota Zen Meditation Center, my home practice center, my friend Wayne came up and he said, nature's all right. I don't know. I'll go on a nature walk every year or two if I have to. But he's from New York. He doesn't have the conditioning that produces this sense of connection and opening and dissolving of the boundaries of the self into something large in that environment, right? Then how about family? Some people are like, yes, when I get in the bosom of my family, I just feel so connected and open with those people, and I feel so supported, naturally supported, and my energy just flows in a way that's beneficial, and it feels really good. And then there may be some people who don't feel that way at all. In fact, in Santa Barbara, someone said, that's possible? So we're various. We're different in the context in which we recognize intimacy or feel it, and the context in which we don't. And the basic position I'm coming from is a Buddhist kind of a position, which is that in every moment that there's consciousness, you have liberative capacity. So in every single moment, you have the opportunity to be opening up into this intimacy. And so we can, basically the book is structured around the idea that we can look into parts of our lives and we can see the ones where we naturally feel intimate, and we can get support in those contexts. We can recognize that we're feeling supported and connected and build on that. And then we can turn to those parts of our life where we feel alienated and cut off. The easy cue, by the way, is just notice how much your mind is thinking about controlling things. That's the easiest way to see if you're feeling non-intimate, I think. Anyway, and in those places, you can build your capacity to open up into connection, to recognizing that you're always in this dynamic relationship of support. I'm from Minneapolis, so I get to talk about Prince if I want to. Prince, if you watch Prince play music, you would see a person disappear into the activity of making the sound and moving the body the way he was moving his body, because he was an amazing dancer as well as singer and instrumentalist and songwriter. So you could just see this immense absorption. And if you would like go to a place where he was playing music, you would see thousands of people opening up into this sense of connection, feeling their kind of aloneness quieting down and opening up into some mysterious, wonderful thing. And they'd all be going, purple rain, and no one knows what purple rain is. I certainly don't. And maybe that's why it was so helped people to open up into a feeling of immense, mysterious connection. Wonderful. So a person can not only cultivate the capacity to experience or manifest intimacy, but can also help other people to open up into it. But it is also true that Prince died alone in an elevator of a drug overdose at the age of 58. So this is kind of it's an extreme example, but it's not that uncommon that people can be amazing at opening up into the infinite in some parts of their lives and also profoundly wounded and manifesting very harmful behavior in another part of their life. So you may not be that extreme, but we can kind of see that we have a constellation of tendencies around this, and that there's ways that we can grow. And I would argue, well, so one of the reasons that I think it's important to take the example of someone like Prince, who's kind of an extreme example, is because he's a powerful and charismatic person with this capacity. And we are in a Zen center. So Zen tradition, Mahayana Buddhism in general, probably all Buddhism, is characterized by charismatic people who have power, who oftentimes have this capacity. You're near them and you feel like you're seeing someone who is opening up into something vast. And the basic premise of our tradition is that mind to mind, one to one, intimately, that person can help us to open up to that ourselves. So people help other people open up. And it's wonderful and it's beautiful. I'm so grateful to my teacher and so many other people I've met who've helped me. But we have seen many, many times teachers who have an amazing capacity to do this also be clearly wounded, unaware of the harm they're doing, and doing very harmful things. Oftentimes it has to do with the power that they are afforded within this hierarchical tradition. A lot of it has been men using their power to sexually exploit women, but that is by no means the whole of it. People do this in many ways. So, we're working on making a form of Buddhism in our country. I think people are working so that this can change, so we do not have to repeat this pattern. And lots of people are working on it, which is wonderful, and it's going to be all different kinds of work. It's a big deal. It's an ongoing project. But one of the things that I think can be helpful is for schools that tend to really emphasize intimacy or non-dualism, for example, Zen, using the psychological precision of early Buddhist mindfulness practice can help. Because it reminds me to look in, I'm supposed to be knowing when I'm experiencing lust. Specifically. Not just be like, oh, there's no lust, no aversion, but say, ah, there it is. Now it's mine to take care of. For example. Or aversion or whatever the quality of mind that could be harmful. So I suppose, you know, you might have come here thinking, oh, mindfulness and intimacy. Ben is going to talk about, you know, how to have a nice relationship with your girlfriend or whatever. And here he is talking about patriarchy and white supremacy and sexual abuse. Good Lord. But I take inspiration from Ida Wells, who was an African-American journalist around the turn of the 19th and the 20th century. And what she's most famous for is working very hard to publicize lynchings. So at the time, it was very public newspapers, magazines, they weren't writing about lynching. It was happening. People knew it was happening, kind of, but let's just not talk about it. And she said, no, I think we should put it in the paper because I think this is newsworthy. Amazing to think that people, oh, that's not really news, is it? So Ida Wells once said, the way to right wrongs is to turn the light of truth upon them. And she was talking about a specific context of lynching journalism. But that teaching of hers is amazingly broad in its scope. The way to right wrongs is to turn the light of truth upon them. This is a central idea of Buddhist thought. We live in a system of harm, a samsara, this huge cycle of harm. And the main practice is turn the light of truth awareness on it. Not turn away from it, not even get rid of it. Just see it, hold it in awareness, and that is healing, profoundly healing. So I'm going to read a little bit from this book. I'm going to read the beginning of a chapter called Heart. So the book is kind of divided up into various aspects of our lives, like body, mind, heart, teachers, community, family, romance, sex, work, play, nature, art, things like this. And then it just investigates how we can be mindful and recognize intimacy in those contexts. This is Heart. Have you ever seen someone laughing in the rain? Or someone stoop-shouldered shuffling along on a green and sunny day? Perhaps in a time of crisis you've seen someone respond with resolve and energy, and someone else collapse into fear or despair. Maybe someone you know gets testy, and then you know it's best to leave them alone. When a loved one is dying, sometimes people are overwhelmed with pain and can barely take care of their basic needs. And sometimes they leap into frantic action to avoid their feelings. And at other times they only know one thing, profound, all-encompassing acceptance and love. I've seen all this in others and in myself as well. One of the clearest insights of my years of meditation is how powerfully my emotions color my experience, my perception of the world. When I am angry, I feel isolated, and I feel the need to control, the need for swift action. When sad, I feel alone and like there's nothing worth doing. I feel like staying in bed. When I'm afraid, I feel vulnerable, like I must get away. When I'm ashamed, I feel abandoned, like everything is pointless. I'm like I'm fundamentally flawed. When I feel intimacy with people in my environment, on the other hand, I feel connected, I trust what's happening, and I am patient and engaged. Afflictive emotions are the reason the practice of mindfulness exists, and why the kind of intimacy this book is about arose as central to Buddhist thought. Buddhism is at its root a set of practices and ideas designed to free human beings from afflictive emotion. So, looking at how Vasubandhu integrates early Buddhist mindfulness practice with Mahayana non-dualism, my big flash of insight came in studying his 30 verses when, about a third of the way through, he lists 50 things which are phenomena. So he's going to say, this is the stuff that is here. And for a long time, I was just like, lists, man. I'm a Zen guy. Don't like lists. And in fact, one of my friends from somewhere in the Bay Area sent me their own translation of the 30 verses. And when it came to that list, it just said, there's a list here. And then she didn't list any of the things. She just skipped it. So that's one way. But I kept looking at it and being like, it's hard to understand all this stuff. And there are a few elements on those lists that are confusing. But I had a blinding flash of the obvious at one point, and I realized about 40 of them are emotional. So Vasubandhu said, here's how consciousness works, and here's the stuff that happens, and 80% of it that I want to talk about is emotional. And I thought, I wonder if Vasubandhu thinks we should pay attention to how we feel. Yeah, I think so. And he didn't just make this up. If you look at the Four Foundations of Mindfulness Sutra, there's a lot of elements. It's fairly complex. But things which we would describe as affective come up in different forms in various categories. Things like desire, aversion, torpor, energy, tranquility, positive valence, negative valence. You get the idea. So it may be really obvious. You may be like, well, of course we gotta pay attention to our feelings, but not everyone thinks this. And I actually don't think, I've never met anyone who seemed to be too aware of their feelings. This hasn't happened. It'll be cool when I do. I'll be like, sweet, what's next? What are you doing now? But for me, this seems like really ongoing, valuable work. Because if you look at what your mind is doing most of the time, it's like blah, 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 or then maybe you're lucky and you hear the birds. But how much can you listen to the bird call of the activity of your own heart? For those people who are practicing Zazen, you don't need to take up all the categories of the Vasubandhu system or the Four Foundations of Mindfulness Sutra. You can just, as you practice Zazen and you become aware of all the stuff happening, you probably become aware of the birds and like the way the floor looks. Just make sure you're being aware of what's happening with your heart, with how you feel. For some people, this is like, well, of course, but not for everybody. Definitely not for everybody. And it is a little bit mysterious because when you start to look at your feelings, they don't exist in space, but they're there. So you have feelings, where are they? So it's kind of hard to look directly at them, but that's okay. Look at them sideways. So, I mean, the really obvious thing everyone in this room probably knows, if you're aware of how you're feeling, you're less likely to just react impulsively out of your feeling, right? So from a Buddhist perspective, we're not karma robots, but we act like it a lot of the time. So we're beings with tons and tons of emotional and cognitive conditioning that drives our behavior. And a lot of the time we have no idea why any of that is happening. And that's why there's so much harm done on our planet and why we do all kinds of stuff that doesn't make any sense. Why we don't even understand why we do most of what we do. But the news is good. The news of Buddhism is good because it says there's all this conditioning, but you can do something about it. That's the Four Noble Truths. There's suffering. It's big, and you can do something about it. And the main thing to do about it is to be aware of it. Shine the light of truth. So, from a Yogacara karma theory perspective, if you can have direct awareness of the feeling as it arises, what happens in that moment is some previous conditioning made that feeling arise. So say you're annoyed. So previous condition causes annoyance to arise. Now in that moment, normally we're not intimately aware of the feeling itself. We're just kind of consumed with thinking about how something is stupid or not even noticing we're agitated. And so what happens is underneath our awareness, another seed of irritation is planted, and later on we'll get to feel that again. On the other hand, if we can just be like, here is the feeling state, the previous conditioning, its power is exhausted in the moment of its being revealed to awareness, and then you plant another seed. And the seed you have planted is one of compassionate awareness, of just seeing. This is the feeling. So this is why I would argue that if you're interested in freeing human beings from suffering, there is not anything more powerful than you can do than to be aware of feeling states as they come into being and pass away. And this becomes not only interpersonal, but you can also do it for other people, which you probably already know, because at some point someone was there for you when you were suffering, and you realize the power of awareness of feeling states. Okay, I got a couple more little things I want to read for you. The next section I'm going to read, you know, as I prepare to go and talk about this, I have to go, oh, I'm going to read some things. What will I read? Because if I read the whole book, we'd all die of boredom or go to sleep. It'd be long. Anyway, so I have to read little parts and I have to pick. And as I was deciding this next part, the reason is pretty simple. It's because it's about someone that I really love and admire and want to share and talk about. So Tomoe Katagiri is, as far as I know, and I'm very willing to be corrected, the first person to teach the sewing of Soto Zen robes in the United States. So I've been traveling around checking up on this. I've done some research, but anyway, as far as I know, the first person to teach our sewing practice here in the U.S. So Daimin Katagiri, her husband, was brought to the U.S. to assist Suzuki Roshi at San Francisco Zen Center about 50 or 60 years ago. And then subsequently, a bunch of Minnesotans convinced Daimin Katagiri to move to Minnesota and found the Minnesota Zen Meditation Center, which, if you like nice weather, was a terrible idea. But he stayed with us, and he died about 25 years ago, but Tomoe still lives. She no longer teaches sewing because her eyesight does not allow her to see the work. But she's still quite wonderful. This chapter is called Teachers. Tomoe Katagiri taught me well, mostly by staying by my side and quietly pouring her energy into what we were doing together. Tomoe-san helped bring the art of sewing Zen monks' robes from Japan to the United States, and she was my teacher in sewing the robes that symbolized my ordination. She gave me precise instruction on the technical aspects of sewing, with which I am far from adept. But to me, her real teaching lay in her embodiments of patience, attention to the present moment, and quiet, warm intimacy. It was not uncommon, as we worked side by side, for us to be silent for an hour at a time to support wholehearted focus on each stitch. After the entire robe is sewn, which took me about a year, it is carefully ironed and folded precisely. Ironed and folded like origami. I frequently found the sewing process frustrating. This is a major understatement. I'm not a natural. But she just calmly stitched away beside me. I recall the moment when I finished the final stitch. A moment I had been waiting for. I said, Tomoe, I finished the robe. I was ready for a birthday cake. Or maybe some fireworks. She put down her sewing and moved to stand up as she said, I'll turn on the iron. Zen teachers can be hard to be around. I don't think she was consciously teaching me, but she brought me right back to what was in front of me. She modeled not living for some other time when the current task, the current manifestation of life is done. She hadn't been waiting for me to finish, and she realized nothing is ever really finished. Life goes on. All things connect. She took care of the world by focusing on the life at hand, and that was teaching enough for me. I was at Hazelden Chemical Dependency Treatment Center in Minnesota, which is a sort of a pioneering treatment place in what we call the land of 10,000 treatment centers. And we used to have all these New Yorkers in Minneapolis who came there for rehab and never left. But anyway, I was at Hazelden, and we have many things. We have inpatient treatment. We have retreats for people in recovery. And we also just have these public talks on Sunday where lots of people come from the area. They're just people who are staying sober and getting sober, and they get support for their practice. So I was there to give a very simple, basic instruction in mindfulness meditation and how mindfulness can be beneficial to addiction recovery. It's just an hour-long thing, very introductory. And so it was nice. We had a little sitting at the end, a Q&A time. This woman put her hand up. I said, yes. And she said, Thank you. You know, that was really nice. I appreciate this because I'm a therapist and I teach mindfulness with my clients all the time. But I've never actually practiced or had any training. Wow! This is what's happening, everybody! This is the most extreme example of this that I have, but it's not all that inconsistent with other things I've heard or people have brought to me to talk about. And on the one hand, I gotta say, how hard is it to say, just notice your breath right now? And certainly, the most therapists, their main thing that they do is they're trained to provide unconditional loving regard. And if that's not mindfulness, I don't know what is. And if you look at the four foundational mindfulness, that would be mindfulness of body externally and mindfulness of emotional states. If we take up some of the categories and sweep them together externally, it's cool. At the same time, I come from a tradition, or am brought up in a tradition, where we really expect people teaching this kind of thing to have spent a few thousand hours practicing meditation and immersing themselves in community and with a teacher and with the Dharma. So I actually don't have a plan for us all, but I just like to remind everyone of what's going on. Because you might be like, I don't have anything to do with that mindfulness stuff because I'm Zen. Pretty cool. But the thing is, intimacy means you're never not part of anything. That's the thing to recognize. We're always part of whatever it is. Anytime there's this other, the other has its place within the way our mind works, but it's not an ultimate truth. So I'm just going to read you one more short thing. The last three chapters of this book are called The Ones We Love, The Ones We Don't Know, and The Ones We Don't Like. And it took a while to determine the title of that last one, because there were a lot of ways to say what I wanted to talk about. This is just the beginning of The Ones We Don't Know. Many old Buddhist teachings say that seeing our interdependence is seeing truth. And not seeing it is ignorance. Ignorance basically means not knowing. If you think about all the things you don't know, how many pins are in your pincushion, how many stars in the sky, how many people laughing within a mile of you, and how many crying right now, how things are for each of the approximately 40 trillion bacteria living as part of your body, where you left your umbrella, what's going on in Yemen right now or on Mars, you get the idea. We're pretty ignorant. It's all right. Let's start there. Let's just take a moment to be intimate with the vastness of our ignorance, like a great ocean of not knowing. Do you know what each of the billions of fish in the sea are experiencing right now? Intimacy with this not knowing situation can open the door for a deeper sense of our interdependence and connection to what we can't know but are already a part of. Usually, we ignore what we don't know. The human mind picks out a tiny, infinitesimal corner of reality and tries to figure it out, and then spends a lot of time feeling like it's got a handle on things. Really, it's ignoring infinite things to give itself a tenuous sense of security in the vastness of this wild, unfurling world. If we practice mindfulness of our body, mind, and heart, we can begin to see the process by which the mind constructs this small picture of the world. We see that our awareness moves between a broad, spacious sense and a constricted, narrow view based on how our body, mind, and heart are interacting. If we practice objectless meditation, that is to say, like shikantaza, where there's no object we choose to focus on, nor no object we are trying to accomplish, if we practice objectless meditation, the mind's categorizing slows, and we tend to actually experience gaps in the mind's tendency to actively ignore most of what is happening. We find ourselves occasionally resting in non-differentiated awareness. While we will always remain in a kind of ignorance about the infinite aspects of the universe, We can diminish the degree to which we actively, though unconsciously, ignore things. This is the path by which we begin to see interdependence, to see a world that is not made of things to judge, control, and manipulate, but a world with which we are intimate and to which we can offer our best effort. All right, well, thank you. Having said many words, I would like now to invite other people to say words. If you like words that are questions, those are good. Or if you have answers, that is good too. Well, anything. How about, yes, you.
Can you say a few words about people's blind spots and how we might become more aware of areas that we habitually don't pay attention to?
Well, one of the things, it just has to do with this mindfulness of emotional states. So really keep paying attention to that carefully. So, especially in those places where you kind of don't want to, that's the place to really know what's happening with me here. The other thing is you can do this interpersonally. So, we want to be able to say to people, hey, that thing you did seemed harmful to me. And, you know, for people with power, it's important to have peers who can do that for you. Because people who are below you in the power structure, there's reasons that they can't do it very well, or it can't be received very well. So, but it has to do with saying we're actively looking into the corners of ourselves. So it's more like an intentional framework than a systematic approach. Although this book is designed to be like, look at this part of your life. So we can kind of see you might start to go, I'm really good at this endo, but like, wow, when I'm driving my car, not so good. So you want to make sure you're carrying your practice in each part of your life, and that's just attitudinal to remind yourself to do it that way. So those are my quickest ideas. Thank you. Yes. Because I'm in an issue in a work situation now where it gets very emotional and I can't really say what I need to say because it's the power of my boss. And that person doesn't seem to recognize that situation. And so it's a bullshit conversation basically because we can't really say what we need to say. And I'm sure I'm fueling it in a way that's not helpful, I guess. But I start to not be able to think straight. So. Yeah. Do I have a safe word? I'm not answering that question.
Okay.
But what I can say is, kind of lining up with this, mindfulness wants us to make things discrete. are look at things as being separate. So one of the things that's handy is it says, in a difficult interpersonal situation, it's reminding us that we can take care of our own feelings as our own feelings, and we can view those as completely separate from what we choose to do and what other people are doing. So it is a compartmentalizing technique. So like if say I'm at a meeting and it's getting all weird and I'm like, I want to just control everybody. So I want to recognize like my feelings are just my feelings. So I want to take care of them as feelings. Then the thing that I think should be happening is a thing that is completely separate from how I feel. And so then I can be like, what would actually be good to do in this? Separate from how I feel. Likewise, oh, this person is becoming very angry. I can be present to them as an angry person. And so it's like there's a compartmentalizing, which can kind of help us to, you know, you're like, what did you say? I get everything is like this.
Yeah.
So mindfulness is nice in that it pulls things apart so you can look at them discreetly. Just look at them like, just with awareness. And that's kind of like an underpinning of how to approach the situation for me. So a lot of times people will say, I have to be angry because then I can get people to do things. Anger is a feeling. Assertiveness is an action. They're not the same thing. You can be totally assertive without being angry, and you can be very angry and not assertive. I know because I'm from Minnesota, where we're really good at passive aggression. So making those discreet can help.
Now, there's a lot of deep, heavy stuff in the book. I just finished it today, but so therefore the story I remember is you just having to sit zazen on the first day of deer season in Minnesota. We don't have that experience here. You could really hear the gunshots.
Oh, lots. Yeah, one year there was a group. They weren't even shooting deer. They had brought burst fire weapons, which go brrr. They're like automatic weapons, basically, and they had dynamite. They were blowing up dynamite next to our temple. Mindfulness! Intimacy with what is. It's like, oh, this is what's happening. It became quite wonderful. Yes.
Mentioned the kind of, and I don't have the words, I'll jump over. You mentioned where the mind goes with intimacy in sexuality or intimacy in sex. And something that I've been questioning recently is the idea of striving towards intimacy and connecting. Realm of honesty with other beings, and the fact that in my experience I find that building intimacy with another person, especially if that person is of a complementary sexual orientation as you, that it elicits this form of lust and goes towards sexuality. So how do you navigate building intimacy in a way where you're also staying upright in your
vow to right use of sexuality. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so true. Sometimes you feel connection to someone, and then it's like, oh, there's some other feelings in there, and in some contexts, it's wonderful. You can realize that, and in other times, it would be really harmful to do so. The main advice on sexuality I have in this book is to honor the feelings, but govern your action. So trying to control any kind of feelings is actually something I don't recommend, but particularly with sexual feelings, we're trained to repress shame and sort of go, oh, this is problematic. And actually the idea is like, you want to know what's going on there. So the good thing is you're like aware that it's coming up. I'm talking about internally. Externally is another question. And then it's like, then you just have to make a choice. How am I going to act? So like I could see someone and be like, oh, we're really connecting and I'm feeling some sexual energy. And I can be like, I am not going to do anything at all that could give this person an idea that I'm feeling this, because I recognize that that would be harmful. And so I've learned, I practice boundaries, right? There might be another case where it's like, oh, it would be wonderful to have sex with this person. I'm married to them, for example. That works out. I hope. Anyway, so on the other hand, other people, you know, some, maybe you're talking about like receiving it, where it's like every time you start to get close to people, they're all like, whoa, let's, you know, you're like, whoa. So then this becomes more a matter of boundaries, of being able to say, just say, that is not what I'm interested in. I'm willing to, you can tell me about how you feel, but I'm not going there with you. So all of this comes down to boundaries between feelings, actions, and interpersonal communication. Again, kind of like the previous thing, it's a boundaried idea. So this is more comes from a mindfulness model. So hopefully that's helpful.
Yeah, I think that's helpful. And I think it also, like, it can become this like ping pong tournament of like, you know, there's a boundary there, and now I'm talking about it, and now we're back in that intimacy. Mm. And then that creates more of like lust associated with intimacy. Like, I think there's just something in the brain with personal theory.
Mm. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. Well, what I'm always advising is find the context where you can have healthy intimacy, and then be boundaried and careful in building your capacity in places where you don't. That's the basic premise that I'm coming from. So I've had relationships where people, I'm like, I'm not even talking to you because we're going to get in trouble. I mean, it was a while ago, I'll be honest. And that was a good choice. So, but then to say, oh, I'm not going to be intimate with anyone, that is not recommended. So, yeah. Thank you. Well, we have been here for a while. I think we should wrap up. So I really appreciate this opportunity to be with you all. It's just such a joy to share practice with you. And I got to say, just feeling the quietness of everyone in this space together. When we started, you know, I know maybe it feels a little cool. You're not part of the community. It feels kind of cold. Warm hearts. We cultivate warm hearts through this silence, moving quietly together, and I feel it. So thank you all very much.